From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, events, and issues that matter to you. Today on the program, we begin with our news summary and the announcement of the resignation of Attorney General John Swallow, effective Tuesday, December 3rd.
I have broken no laws and have vowed to fight for my honor and good name with my very last dollar. And we have done as a family basically that.
We'll also have a conversation with Don Duff, a former Air Force intelligence official who had a front row seat to the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis.
And I told the airman, I said, they're right, they're definitely missile trailers. But wait a minute, there's something there I see. Let's zoom in on that. So we enlarged the frame, and that's when I saw a missile on the missile trailer.
All that just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. And thanks once again for tuning into The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up later in the program, we're going to take a look at the Cuban Missile Crisis, one of the defining moments of the Kennedy presidency. But first up, we have these headlines. After a year in office and facing ever-increasing scrutiny from a House inquiry and criminal investigations, Utah Attorney General John Swallow has announced his resignation, effective Tuesday, December 3rd. KCPW's Ryan Cunningham has more.
Earlier in the day on Thursday, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Robert Gerke reported that the Attorney General was expected to resign in light of a forthcoming report by the Lieutenant Governor's office. Though Swallow has now denied that the report weighed on his decision to resign, that report is expected to cite several election law infractions committed by Swallow. Just hours later, Swallow confirmed to KSL News Radio's Doug Wright that he would indeed be stepping down on Thursday, with an announcement coming later in the day at a press conference. Speaking to reporters at the Capitol boardroom, Swallow was defiant, maintaining that he was innocent of any wrongdoing.
I have broken no laws and have vowed to fight for my honor and good name with my very last dollar. And we have done as a family basically that. The strain on my office has been far beyond what I ever anticipated, and the cost to the state and taxpayers has been enormous. Now is the time for the madness to stop and for the state to move forward.
Despite firmly denying the charges against him, Swallow did admit that he regretted not being more careful when filing to run for Attorney General.
When I was making my filings for Attorney General, there were some questions I had, legal questions I had, about what I needed to include in the filing or not. In hindsight, I wish if I'd known it would be an issue at all, I just would have disclosed it anyway. Now, the problem with that was I had to sign on the line saying that what I was writing was true and accurate to the best of my belief. And so when I talked to my lawyer about it, and then later when I talked to the election lawyer for the state about it, they both agreed that it was not something I needed to disclose. So I didn't. But I wish in hindsight that I had just taken that off the table. But you just don't know in the present that something might become an issue later on.
Swallow's interim replacement is expected to be nominated sometime next month, but it remains to be seen whether the special House investigation of the Attorney General will continue. Governor Gary Herbert issued a brief statement on Swallow's announcement, saying he had accepted his letter of resignation and requested that the Republican State Central Committee, quote, convene as soon as is practical, unquote, to pick three potential appointees for the governor to choose from. He added that, quote, John's decision is in the best interest of his family, his constituents, and the state of Utah, unquote. Swallow was elected to office last year, but has been dogged by implications of wrongdoing for virtually his entire tenure. Accusations against the outgoing attorney general range from failing to disclose business dealings as part of election filings to improper influence peddling in exchange for donations. Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill says that the announcement won't likely have an effect on the criminal investigation of the Attorney General by his office. In Salt Lake City, I'm Ryan Cunningham for KCPW.
The U.S. has a lot of depleted uranium that needs to be stored, and Energy Solutions wants to get in on the action. A decision on whether the company will be able to store the low-level radioactive waste in Utah will be made next year. But over the next few months, the Division of Radiation Control will be looking at a study on the safety of the waste, which may ultimately determine if depleted uranium comes to the state. KCPW's Kim Shusky of Explore Utah Science has that story.
The U.S. has 700,000 metric tons of depleted uranium that needs to find a permanent resting place. The waste was generated as a byproduct during uranium enrichment for nuclear weapons and to produce the fuel used in nuclear power plants. Energy Solutions, the low-level radioactive storage facility in Clive, 65 miles west of Salt Lake City, may become one home for the waste pending a decision from the state. But it's not an easy decision to make because depleted uranium is unlike other radioactive material stored in Clive, says Rusty Lundberg, who is the director of the Division of Radiation Control, which will oversee the decision-making process.
It has some unique characteristics that differs from other radioactive materials and waste that they dispose of there. One of the most significant is that over a long period of time, depleted uranium and its decay products actually increase in radioactivity, whereas the more normal process is that radioactive materials decay and continue to decay. So this makes this more unique and more important for our deliberate and more focused consideration and evaluation of this proposal.
Depleted uranium is only 60% as radioactive as natural uranium, but as it decays, the byproducts are more radioactive and are also toxic in other ways. Turi Serling is a professor of geology at the University of Utah.
By itself, the depleted uranium is more dangerous as a toxin than its radioactivity.
A large increase in radioactivity due to decay will not occur for a long time, peaking at 2.1 million years.
Uranium, when it was taken out of the ground, may have been there for millions of years, so we know that it can be in a configuration for millions of years and not move very far away. So it's done that naturally, and millions of years is the time scale that it will continue to be around.
To get a better handle on the health and safety risks that storage of the waste may pose to Utahns, the Utah Division of Radiation Control required Energy Solutions to complete a study or performance assessment that looks at many possible issues and scenarios that might threaten waste containment at their facility over the next 10,000 and more years. This includes the risk of groundwater contamination, seismic activity, and the role plants, insects, and burrowing animals may have in compromising the waste containment structure. The embankment that Energy Solutions proposes to use to contain the waste is above ground. Current regulations only require that the embankment perform its function for a minimum of 500 years. Utah is somewhat on its own in figuring out how to regulate storage of depleted uranium, since the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Agency has not put forward clear rules. Director Lundberg says state and federal regulators are all coming to the conclusion that a site-specific evaluation, like the one Energy Solutions has undertaken, will be critical.
The intent is that to look at each individual site, taking into consideration its unique physical and location characteristics, not only now, but in the long term, and then make that judgment based upon that input and that information as to, is it acceptable for disposal?
None of this comforts Park City resident Travis Bray.
Any person who studies any aspect of storage knows that there is no such thing as 100,000-year concrete. It doesn't exist. At some point, storage facilities will break down.
Bray went to an open house last week hosted by the Division of Radiation Control, which is hoping to engage the public on the storage issue. Bray says he came to the open house because after just moving to the state in September, he recently found out that there was a possibility that depleted uranium would be stored in his new home. He isn't just a concerned citizen, but one with a PhD in chemistry from Auburn University. He studied how radioactive heavy metals called actinides could affect the environment around the Yucca Mountain Nuclear Waste Repository in Nevada.
I did 4 years of research modeling what's going to happen when Yucca broke down, what minerals will uptake actinides, the redox chemistry of these actinides in the environment, how are they going to move through. I mean, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when.
Bray says he hopes people will still be living in the area thousands of years in the future, and they will want to know what we did that might have compromised their environment. Chris Sloan is a realtor in Tooele who also came to the open house. He supports Energy Solutions' plan and says the company is an important economic engine for the county.
They support our youth, they support our business community, they employ a ton of our people that live and work in Tooele County.
Sloan says he personally isn't worried about the long-term effects of storing depleted uranium near his community.
If I'm going to live to be 61,050, then I might have some concerns. And let me couch that by also saying that I'm fairly certain before it gets back to full strength, technology will also be evolving from the storage side. I have no problems sleeping at night knowing that the technology will also advance over the time they're worried about the increased heat.
The Division of Radiation Control is expected to begin a technical analysis of the performance assessment soon, take public comments in July, and make a final decision at the end of next year. For KCPW and Explore Utah Science, I'm Kim Shusky.
And those are our local headlines for the day. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. Stay with us. Tomorrow marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Today on The Rundown, we'll be taking a look at one of the seminal events of the Kennedy presidency. We're joined by Don Duff, a former Air Force intelligence official who had a front row seat to the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. Don Duff, thanks for joining us today in the studio to have this conversation. What I was hoping you could do is bring us back to October of 1962.
In October of 62, I was in the Air Force, and I was assigned to Strategic Air Command at Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, Nebraska. And we were in SAC headquarters. We were a top secret intelligence unit, and we were located three stories underground next to the command center or the war room. And our job was to analyze U-2 imagery and our new spy-in-the-sky satellite imagery over Russia and China. But with the ongoing tension in Cuba with Russia and Fidel Castro, a lot of our intelligence work was shifted towards the Isle of Cuba. And we began looking at Cuba through U-2 photography and satellite imagery.
And you had recent U-2 spy plane photography available to review, correct?
Yes, we had some in 62 and some in 61, too. But the U-2s weren't authorized to overfly directly over the island. It wasn't until Kennedy authorized it later in 62, in October, when the crisis really started heating up, that he authorized a direct overflight. From before that, it was looking in, sort of in a blike photography, if you will.
And what we're obviously talking about is the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I'm wondering, you're sitting three stories underground. Is that in case of an attack and being able still to operate?
Yes, SAC headquarters was a large, I think it's a three-story building, but there was three stories underground. And the command center or war room was in the basement, and that's where our lab was, our special top secret project office. It was like behind a big bank vault door, and you had to have code words to get in. And that was just where the security, the intelligence, where all the top secret information, the top floors of the office buildings, so to speak, were just, you know, routine Air Force admin for Strategic Air Command.
The president and the nation wasn't aware of the fact that there was this missile installation so nearby in Cuba. Maybe you could tell us the story of discovering evidence of this site in Cuba.
Well, it's kind of a long story, but I'll keep it short. As I mentioned, President Kennedy authorized a direct flight over the island, and it was... Let me back up. In late August, through a spy in the sky satellite imagery, we discerned a surface-to-air missile site, or SAM site, on the north coast of Cuba. And these were in a Star of David configuration with six missile points around and a control center in the center. And we knew from our Russian experience that these SAM sites, if you will, usually were constructed around Soviet missile sites. So we were fairly confident that we would find offensive missiles in Cuba, but nobody had found them yet. And Khrushchev kept denying this situation. At that time, there was a lot of ships coming into Cuba with cargo freights and everything, and we discerned that there could be missiles and aircraft parts in these crates. Well, the CIA was reluctant to confirm this at the time. So eventually, Kennedy authorized a direct overflight because things were getting very, very tense, so to speak. And that was on October 14th, 1962. U-2 took off from Edwards Air Force Base in California, overflew the north coast of Cuba, and landed at McCoy Air Force Base in Florida. From there, General Smith, our director of intelligence, took the film to Washington, D.C. The CIA was there, but he said, no, we're in charge, because Kennedy had authorized the Air Force to take over the U-2 program after the Bay of Pigs, when the CIA kind of based on faulty intelligence, it was a disaster.
So they'd authorized the Air Force to manage the U-2 spy plane program.
Right, right. And so the direct overflight, like I said, took over on October 14th, and the film was sent to Washington, D.C. General Smith had taken the tracker film from the U-2 and rushed that to Offutt Air Force Base immediately when the plane landed. Now, the tracker film is a 70-millimeter film that's in the U-2. And in the past, the CIA would give it to us so that we could plot the flight line of the U-2. Okay. But we were able to discern a lot more intelligence from the tracker film than the CIA thought we could. So it was during that time, Sunday afternoon, when our crew, the day shift, we worked 24/7. I was in graveyards. The day shift looked at the tracker film, and on one construction site, they saw these missile trailers. Mm. And this was the first evidence where, oh, missile trailers, there's got to be missiles around. So they notified the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington, D.C., the Pentagon, and we can assume President Kennedy. The discovery, actually, of the missile trailers was made by my roommate in the Air Force at that time. Anyway, I was looking forward to the graveyard shift, midnight to late in the morning. Well, General Smith had got the film developed in D.C., and he had made arrangements for a duplicate set. And he flew that immediately to Offutt Air Force Base that evening. And it got there about midnight, just when I was starting the graveyard shift. So I was interested in looking at these construction sites that we had previously seen. I was in charge of four airmen. We had two airmen to a machine in a darkened room, and we had a large screen viewing thing almost the size of half the size of a large screen TV set today. So I said, let's screen these construction sites. So as we were going through, we found the site where these missile trailers were. I told the airman, I said, they're definitely missile trailers. But wait a minute, there's something there I see. Let's zoom in on that. So we enlarged the frame, and that's when I saw protruding from one of the missiles, uncovered, was a missile on the missile trailer. And so that was the first indication that, yes, there were missiles in Cuba. And so we passed the word on to the Pentagon, and we can assume President Kennedy again. And meanwhile, the CIA was looking at their film Monday morning and into the Monday afternoon, and they didn't decide or confirm that there was an actual missile until about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Well, that was about 14 hours after we had already discovered it and decided it was a missile.
Yeah.
And they called a briefing for President Kennedy the next morning at 11:30 to tell him about it. But we thought, well, you know, he already knew about it. But anyway, we prepared briefing materials for General Powers to take back to the briefing. We prepared a 36 by 36 inch large enlargement of the missile site, a range map of Cuba that showed all the missile sites on the island, suspected and confirmed, that we had found, because even by the end of that night, we had found other sites that we suspected were missile sites. And we also had a range map from Cuba that had concentric circles from Havana that showed the range of the medium range and intermediate range ballistic missiles from Cuba to the United States.
Did those concentric circles basically cover the entirety of the United States?
Yeah, they essentially covered the entirety of the Western Hemisphere. And with the medium-range ballistic missile from Havana, it could have covered Washington, D.C., Kansas City, Dallas. With the intermediate-range ballistic missiles, which we found some sites later on, which were classified as intermediate range, they could reach up to Boston, Toronto, Chicago, Minneapolis, Denver. So the threat was real.
You know, here's a question that often gets asked about the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I'll just get your take on it. You know, how close were we to the brink? You know, how close did we come to nuclear war?
We were pretty close. I'll use my two fingers here, and it's like a millimeter separating it. Kennedy had, after the briefing, or after he went on the national TV on the 22nd of August to brief the nation about we know that Russia has missiles there, but they kept an eye on it. So the next couple days, he devised an invasion plan for Cuba for October 23rd. They changed it to the 29th to give the military more time to get ready. But it went on and on till a U-2 was shot down on the 27th by a Russian colonel who disregarded Khrushchev's warning not to shoot, but the urging of Castro, he fired. The missile exploded in proximity to the U-2, causing damage, and it crashed. The pilot was killed. Later that day, another U-2 violated Soviet airspace off Siberian coast. It was a mistake. It just got off course. Well, Russia scrambled MiGs, and Kennedy had to get on the phone to Khrushchev to say, look, this was a mistake. We are not attacking you. This was Saturday the 27th. But he said, Mr. Khrushchev, I'm giving you an ultimatum. Either you withdraw your missiles now and your troops, or we will bring full retaliatory power against you and go to war in Cuba. And Khrushchev thought about it that night, and on Sunday the 29th, less than 24 hours from the invasion, because it was set for the Monday the 29th at 9 o'clock in the morning, so October 28th, Khrushchev addressed the Soviet leadership and said, you know, I think we ought to back down. Why risk a thermonuclear war, which is going to destroy our nation, United States, and probably the world? So we were within 18 hours of an invasion. We were that close.
The policy of mutually assured destruction, the idea that that's your deterrent, you know, when you look back on it, you know, being so near to it, did you feel the threat even more?
Yeah, I felt the threat even more. But being there in the Air Force, three stories underground, and doing just your specific intelligence work, you had no idea what the rest of the military was doing. It was only after, you know, now I'm retired, I did some research, and it's in the history books what happened. But yeah, at that time, the threat was real. And when we went to Defense Condition 2, which is DEFCON 2, on October 24th, it was lockdown. I mean, it was total security. Our building was supposedly built so that three stories underground, pounds per square inch, the concrete was such that a direct missile, we could have survived.
Wow.
But still, the threat was real. You know, given that Sunday when Khrushchev made the decision not to go to war and withdraw the troops, I was still on graveyard shift, and I was like, well, you know, I don't know if I want to go out at 8 o'clock in the morning. Maybe I'll volunteer for some day shift work and stay just to make sure.
Right. That would make sense. I could be physically ill as a result of knowing what's going on around me. You know, we could talk out the end of the crisis. There's the blockade, and then there's a drawdown of a withdrawal of the missiles eventually.
Yeah, eventually there's a withdrawal of missiles, and it took another 8 or 9 months from then, the end of October, for the Russians to withdraw their troops and the missiles and their aircraft under the surveillance of the Air Force and the Navy. So the threat wasn't over. It was still ongoing into 1963, and SAC was still on alert, as so was the military. But we weren't. We went back to DEFCON 3 later on. So.
We just marked the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy. I don't know if you're the right person to ask this, but I always wonder if it had an effect on the mentality of our opponents in the world. You know, was there an inkling of sympathy from the Russians?
Well, I think there was probably an inkling of sympathy, but there was also maybe a thought, well, now, you know, Kennedy's gone, we can get on with maybe putting the fist to the United States and the rest of the world. But we have to watch them because they are vigilant. And Kennedy took a lot of heat over the Bay of Pigs when that CIA debacle happened. And he was looked at as weak. But during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he showed a lot of tenacity and a lot of skillful diplomacy in defusing this situation. And, you know, he came to Offutt Air Force Base around early December and thanked General Powers and us, our secret unit, and for being the watchdogs and providing intelligence. And he said, you know, if I ever need any up-to-date, reliable, factual intelligence to make a decision, I'm coming to you. And this kind of wore on the CIA a little bit because they thought they were the premier intelligence group. And I think there was some jealousy on the CIA. And so that enters into the conspiracy theory along with, you know, others, the mobsters and the oil men and whatever else,
you know. Don, I appreciate your coming in and speaking with us.
Well, thank you, Roger.
That was former Air Force intelligence official Don Duff sharing his recollections about the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. Duff is speaking at a commemoration this evening at 7 p.m. at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, celebrating the life and legacy of President John F. Kennedy. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. We'll be right back. And that's all the time we have for our show today. The Rundown was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis and Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to take a look at a new study charting the difficulties faced by Mormon missionaries who come home early. But in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at KCPWRundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.